Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Aurora, Colorado shootings, as is usually the case after a gun-related mass killing, recently inspired renewed debate over gun regulation in the United States. And whenever that happens, the letters NRA or the National Rifle Association are invoked. Founded in 1871, the NRA now boasts more than 4.3 million members and is the chief opponent of gun control in the United States. This hour, we'll consider how this organization has gathered its political clout throughout the years, becoming one of the nation's 10 largest lobbies. The NRA at the national and regional level did not respond to our request for an interview for this show. Joining us now is Richard Feldman. He's an attorney, former police officer, Reagan White House appointee, and one-time regional political director for the NRA. He is currently a political consultant, lecturer, and author of the book Ricochet, Confessions of a Gun Lobbyist. Richard Feldman, welcome to the show.
Thank you kindly.
To our listeners, are you a member of the NRA? Why did you join, and are you satisfied with its work over the years? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Richard Feldman, you've called the NRA a cynical, mercenary political cult. That's a quote. Cult is a loaded term. You worked with the NRA for almost 20 years, so you were part of that cult or unaware of it? Why do you use that particular term?
Well, that might have been a little hyperbole for okay. The book. I think if you're uninitiated to the firearm culture and you want to try and understand it quickly, the best analogy I think I've ever heard is it's akin to a religious organization. There are true believers, and there are millions and millions of our fellow Americans who view their relationship to this democracy of ours in terms of the gun issue. And what I mean by that is that basically if the government doesn't mess with them and they've owned all these guns for all these years, and they've never done anything wrong with them, and the government doesn't try and take it, they basically say, well, all right, this is a government essentially worthy of my trust. When those very same citizens feel that the government, because of a tragedy like Aurora with a lunatic, somehow preventing those tragedies by taking away my guns, interfering with my rights, is going to stop those kinds of tragedies, then this is no longer a government which I should be so trusting of. And that, in a nutshell, explains the power, the potency, and the force of the gun rights issue in America.
You and the NRA essentially parted ways because you were willing to negotiate. Now, you didn't work with the NRA or work for the NRA at that time. Can you tell us why you parted ways the way you did?
Well, I was representing the firearm industry, the manufacturers, distributors, and retailers, and it seemed at the time in the best interests of my clients who I worked for to find a way around the problem of children negligently getting a hold of a gun and causing harm. And by providing a child safety lock, which now is it's not even controversial now, but when we decided to go forward with it, it was kind of controversial, and it led to a little brouhaha between myself and the NRA. But at this point now, it's kind of past history. And, people say to me, you've taken the other side. No, I'm still a very proud member of the NRA. I'm an endowment member of the NRA. And, almost like a religious group, we have internal squabbles. We don't always see things 100% the same way. But diversity is a good thing.
My guest is Richard Feldman. He's an author and also a former regional political director for the NRA. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And just want to remind listeners that we did request an interview with the NRA at the national and the regional level, and we were not, there was no response to our request. So, Richard Feldman, where does the NRA get its financial clout? Is it from its considerable membership base, 4.3 million, nothing to sniff at, or is it something else?
No, actually, people seem to focus on the wrong thing, seems to me, most of the time. they always look at the money. And if money went away in politics across the board, an organization like the NRA would be 10 times stronger than it is today. And the reason is it is the quintessential grassroots organized interest group in the country. If you oppose the NRA because you disagree with the policy, hey, that's fine. But if you oppose the NRA because they're too powerful, what you're really saying is you're kind of anti-democratic representation. After all, the NRA represents its membership, and it has influence way beyond just the membership of the 4.2 or 4.3 million. There's another 20 million people that feel like they're members of the NRA that currently technically aren't. They're past members, their gun club is involved with the NRA, a family member is in the NRA, and they read the magazine. So their clout is way, way beyond just their simple legal membership numbers.
I know people who are own firearms who don't belong to the NRA, and I know people who have never owned a gun of any kind, any firearm, who are avid members of the NRA.
That's not surprising. When it comes to protecting your rights, you don't have to use the right to want to be able to maintain that right, because once you lose a right, it's gone forever. And you know, the folks in Ohio, it's not really been terribly well known, but Ohio played an absolutely critical role in the 2004 election cycle. If your listeners will recall, Bush won the Ohio by about 120,000 votes, a shift of 61,000 votes in Ohio, and Kerry would have won the state and the presidency in the Electoral College. So, and the gun issue has played a very important role in politics over the last 20 years nationally and in the Buckeye State, because it took a long time to get concealed carry and other legislative agendas through the legislature there in Columbus. So it's got a very well-organized, geared-up gun rights community.
Right. We tend to focus on the national level, and I did in my introduction, but the NRA is very active at the state level across the country.
Well, you know, people that like it, you know, say, gee, that's great. And people who go, well, you know, oh, that's, I oppose it. That's bad. Well, that's outcome determinative. When you're looking at, you know, democracy, don't you want people engaged? Don't you want people to support those who support them? I mean, I'm always fascinated when somehow you see a report that goes, imagine that, the NRA supported these candidates. How odd that you would support candidates that support your positions. And they oppose candidates that oppose their positions.
Mm-hmm.
I scratch my head and go, what would you expect? I certainly don't expect the Brady campaign to support pro-gun gun rights advocates and oppose gun control advocates. You know, so much of our terminology in this debate, it really gets us into the wrong direction.
And yet,
words itself, gun control, mm-hmm. mean different things to different people in this debate. Gun control has very little to do with crime control. Controlling guns and controlling the misuse of guns are two separate and distinct issues, almost unrelated to one another.
You mentioned it's a quintessential grassroots organization, the most quintessential in the country. So how much does the NRA have to do with the gun manufacturers, with the distributors, with the retailers?
Well, I'd say that just from my own judgment, probably better than 75% of people involved in the firearm business belong to NRA,
mm-hmm.
Because they're looked at as sort of the granddaddy of the movement, and it's supporting your customer base, or at least your most well-organized customer base. But the bulk of NRA's money doesn't come from the industry. It comes from the membership. Sure, some of it comes from the industry. So what? You know, you can look. I bet you any beer drinkers group gets a lot of money from Anheuser-Busch. Is that shocking,
mm-hmm.
surprising, frightening? What would you expect? I doubt Anheuser-Busch gave large quantities of money to Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Maybe. Because for honesty purposes, I have to say that I've always been a member of that the opposite group, DAM, Drinkers Against Mad Mothers. No, I'm kidding.
You said that the mainstream media doesn't get how the NRA operates, and that was... And that's been to the glee of the NRA leaders. They thrived on the media's treatment as fodder for fundraising and other efforts. Where's the disconnect? How should the media cover the NRA?
Well, you know, when you look just at one slice of the pie, you get a two-dimensional reading of something that's at least three and maybe four dimensions in scope, size, and nuance. It's much more complicated, these issues, than superficially. I sort of enjoy it when someone like Mayor Bloomberg from New York says, gee, it's just common sense to do this. If it's so commonsensical, one has to ask why we haven't done it. And the answer is that it isn't common sense, and it's much more complicated than he would like to make it. People do not plan on giving up their guns. And yet, if you ask the question correctly, which folks like Bloomberg never do, you get almost unanimity in agreement. Everyone would like to keep guns out of the hands of violent, predatory criminals, young children, and mental lunatics. So we're in agreement on the outcome. Why do we allow the debate to focus on the wrong elements, which is always the gun, as though somehow magically one gun is a good gun, another gun is a bad gun? Guns have no teleology. People have that. If you focus on keeping the guns out of the wrong hands, as Sarah Brady used to say, then we're in agreement in large measure on who the wrong hands are. And we could move this issue forward. But as long as we're fighting over the silliness, well, if the gun has a folding stock, it becomes a bad gun. If it holds 14 rounds instead of 10 rounds, it's a bad gun, but this is a good gun. You know, to me, any loaded firearm pointed at me is an assault weapon, and any loaded firearm in my hands is a defensive device I can use to protect myself, my family, and my community. It's as simple as that.
Is the course of the conversation, though, strictly a function of those who oppose the NRA and the media and how it covers it? Or doesn't the NRA tend to have a knee-jerk reaction anytime anyone brings up any kind of anything regarding regulating the sale or the use of guns?
Well, you know, I think the NRA has really matured over the years. And well, 20 years ago, after a horrible incident involving guns, NRA may have been very much out there, but now, you know, you don't see much of NRA. I think that's very wise. They recognize they're a lightning rod in this debate, and their involvement at the moment isn't really that helpful to their success. And their success is the success of American gun owners. You know, Americans don't want to give up their guns. They're not going to give up their guns. So what I say to the other side is, when you can't beat them, join them. You will not defeat the gun rights community by being anti-gun, but you can move the agenda forward on keeping guns out of the wrong hands from the pro-gun community side. That's why I have an organization called the Independent Firearm Owners Association, because this issue is more complicated, more nuanced, and it's not so black and white. And there are some answers out there to some questions, but there's no instant answer that solves very much of anything.
Well, I want to hear more about the Independent Firearm Owners of America with Richard Feldman. He's going to stay with us. He's author and former regional political director for the NRA. Coming up, we're going to hear from Robert Spitzer, another expert on the NRA. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you. This is Neil Cohen, and here's some of what we're working on for the week ahead on Talk of the Nation. Ted Koppel and planning for the day after in Syria. Political junkie Ken Rudin rates the best and worst vice presidential candidates from Bill Miller to John Edwards. And Chris Hedges on the places America's abandoned. That and, of course, much more in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation, Monday through Friday from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 78 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high near 90 degrees. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 66. Mostly sunny with a chance of afternoon showers and thunderstorms on Tuesday, a high of 92. Partly cloudy with a chance of rain Tuesday night, a low of 69. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the history and power of the National Rifle Association. Where did it come from and how did it amass such power? The NRA at the national and regional levels did not respond to our requests for an interview for this show. Still with us is Richard Feldman. He's author and former regional political director of the NRA. Richard, once again, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Pleasure to be here.
Joining us now is Robert Spitzer. He is a political science professor for the State University of New York. He's also a member of the NRA and the author of 14 books, including The Politics of Gun Control and The Encyclopedia of Gun Control. Welcome to the show, Robert.
It's good to be with you.
Most people today, Bob, see the NRA as an organization devoted to gun owners' rights, but it wasn't always that way. The organization was founded to promote gun safety, right?
Well, not quite.
Okay.
It was founded in 1871 by two Civil War veterans who were dismayed at the abysmal skills of the typical American male with guns. And to improve sharpshooting and marksmanship skills, they formed the NRA back in 1871. And that was its primary focus in its first decades of operation. It was a fairly small organization. Gradually over time, it began to encompass other gun-related activities, like hunting and other sporting sorts of activities. It became involved in political activities in the 1930s when the federal government moved to enact the first sort of modern national gun laws, the first one of those being in 1934. But it continued to maintain a pretty heavy emphasis on traditional hunting, sporting, recreational activities, leaning to some degree to sort of conservation-type activities. And then in the 1960s and 70s, it became involved more expressly in politics. You had a series of things happening in the 1960s, several political assassinations and urban violence and disorder, and that pushed the government to enact a gun control law in 1968 that the NRA became involved in terms of testimony and other things. And then in 1977, the NRA, which holds a convention every year, in that particular year, 1977, a group of more conservative or radical, if you care to say it that way, wing and more political faction within the NRA won control of the organization. And from that point forward, it became conservative and also more expressly political, devoting more resources to political activities, and that kind of brought us up in general terms to where we are today.
When you talk about the radical and conservative taking over, is there any other branch of the NRA left anymore?
Well, there certainly, the NRA certainly continues to provide services and information and activities relating to hunting and sporting and those sorts of things. But in terms of the organization's resources and its overall agenda, it's become a much more political organization. But it certainly, you know, NRA members provide marksmanship, gun training classes. They do a lot of things in sort of traditional target shooting, hunting, sporting area, and I mean, that continues to be important to the NRA as well, but of course its political activities are the ones that most people know about.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Spitzer. He teaches political science at the State University of New York. He's also an expert on the NRA and the history of the NRA. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've said that how the Second Amendment was interpreted originally was not an issue until the 20th century. What changed? Did it come about with that takeover in the 70s?
Well, it's interesting. If you go back, for example, to the 1930s, when Congress enacted a federal law that barred civilian possession of automatic weapons and impose some other regulations. Officers of the NRA testified before Congress and pretty extensively, and there was no invocation of any of that element of the law as running afoul of the Second Amendment. And you'd have to scan, while there are sort of occasional references to the sort of historic right to bear arms, you really didn't see or find any specific invocation of the Second Amendment as having anything in particular to do with the gun activities that the NRA was noted for. But the Second Amendment becomes kind of a talisman for the NRA, beginning with its more conservative turn. And the rhetoric of constitutional rights, of the right to bear arms, began to accelerate. And it reflects the fact that the Second Amendment historically was understood both by the people who wrote it and by the courts who interpreted it for about 130 years or so as an amendment that protected the right of citizens to bear arms, but only in connection with their service in a government-organized and regulated militia. But a new interpretation, what's referred to as the individualist view, gained some currency first from a law review article that was published in 1960. And more writing, a great deal of it promoted directly or indirectly by the NRA, began to advance this view. And finally, in 2008, the Supreme Court, backtracking on what it had said in the past, embraced this individualist view in a Supreme Court case called the Heller case. And then 2 years later, in 2010, it applied that case to the states and that principle to the states. So we now have indeed enshrined in the law for the first time this constitutional interpretation that the Second Amendment does protect an individual right of civilians, of citizens, to have a, as the court said, to have a handgun in the home for personal self-protection. And that obviously has become an important focal point of the debate, although the Supreme Court was also very careful in saying that that right was not an unlimited right, that it was bounded by and that the courts accepted the traditional view, that is, traditional laws and traditional regulations, so that most existing gun laws would pass constitutional muster. That hasn't all shaken out because there are hundreds of cases bubbling around in the courts around the country challenging gun laws. But up until today, gun laws, by and large, have withstood a constitutional challenge on Second Amendment grounds.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the NRA, its history, and going forward with Robert Spitzer. He is teaches political science at the State University of New York. He's also a member of the NRA and the author of Politics of Gun Control and the Encyclopedia of Gun Control. And still with us, Richard Feldman, author and former regional political director of the NRA. His, if you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. In an NPR article from January 2011, Robert Spitzer, you said that the NRA has toned down its rhetoric in recent years, that it climaxed in the 1990s. And Richard Feldman, you said earlier that the NRA has matured. I was wondering what, you know, both of you think, why did it tone, you, whether it's the phrase is toned down or the word is matured, why in recent years? Richard Feldman?
Well, I think that NRA has learned from some of the mistakes they made in the past, and they've learned how to deal better with hot button moments like these, post a Columbine, post an Aurora. I would disagree with my colleague, Mr. Spitzer, there just a little bit. When the NRA became very involved in the political, I would call them activists. I would not characterize them particularly as conservative until the probably the beginnings of the reign of Wayne LaPierre. Only in the last 15, 18, 20 years has, I think, it taken more of a, felt itself more as part of the greater Republican conservative movement. When I was at NRA, we support an awful lot of Democrats. They tended to be more rural Democrats than urban Democrats, but there was quite a bit more of a split.
And now, not at all.
No, that's not true. Not true at all. John Dingell probably wouldn't be in Congress today if it wasn't for NRA's backing and a couple of tough primaries he's had in the years. And there are plenty of Democrats that would, both at the state and federal level, I don't think Harry Reid would have survived too well if he had been on the wrong side of the gun issue in the last election cycle. But it is true that the Democrats that are in tough races, it isn't always enough to help them, where I think the organized gun community has become much more conservative, Republican, and I emphasize organized gun community. There are millions and millions of self-identified liberals, 10, 15 million self-identified liberals in this country that own guns. That's 4 or 5 times the size of the NRA, but they're not organized on the gun issue.
Bob Spitzer?
Interesting points. I think Richard Feldman is quite right in saying that the NRA became more politically activist. I mean, that's quite right. I would just say that I think it's pretty clear they did take an ideological sharp right turn after 1977. Relatively speaking, they do endorse Democrats and always have, but statistically speaking, they tend to endorse Republicans far more than Democrats. I mean, not a surprise, the Republican Party's the more conservative party. Their support among Republicans probably peaked around 2000 when the NRA became a co-sponsor of the Republican National Convention. So they really put their chips in with the Republican Party by and large. They were still endorsing some Democrats, but the number of Democrats they endorsed in 2000 was at, I think, a historic low, and it's increased some since then, you know, with the resurgence of the Democrats in 2006 and 2008. So they do make bipartisan endorsements, but they tend to lean to the Republicans pretty strongly.
Mark and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, yes. Well, first off, I do own a couple of weapons. I also have a concealed permit, and I am not an NRA member at present, but I'm considering it because, quite frankly, I'm kind of, well, appalled by the hypocrisy, I think, of the of the anti-gun or gun control movement, because at least with the NRA, they're upfront about what they stand for. When you talk to somebody behind the scene, they'll say that, well, yes, we're for gun control and we want to limit things, you know, assault weapons and whatnot. But, you know, once the mic's turned off, you take them into the hallway, they'll say, you know, we wouldn't mind seeing the whole Second Amendment repeal. Just do away with the whole thing. It's out of date.
Can you give me some examples of who you're talking about there?
Well, if I see someone that's having a poster, you know, anti-gun poster or anything like this, or if you see the tweets that are on, you know, like people will say, well, like the Second Amendment was for muskets or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It just shows, you know, what the mindset is for people that, well, you're just never going to change their point of view. Also, too, if it wasn't for the NRA or people like them, I wouldn't have heard about the UN Small Arms Treaty that just came up, where they're trying to end round things, doing away with people owning weapons and just having governments in charge of weapons. I think that's a dangerous thing as well. And so I just appreciate hearing what both of your commentators would have to say on that.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Sure.
Robert? Or...
Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Robert.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I would just make the point, I guess, about the NRA that, I mean, in politics is a funny game, but I think the NRA does kind of play two different kinds of games, political games, that is. I mean, it relies on what you could only, I think, characterize as pretty hysterical rhetoric about the issues of the day. You see it certainly in their own publications and in much of their kind of public persona. The UN Small Arms Treaty is a good example. I mean, they've been sort of the UN is one of the NRA's demons, and they pound relentlessly away at the UN, and it's pretty easy to do that. It's a multinational organization. And there is this sort of notion that the UN is on the verge of somehow abrogating the Second Amendment, which is sheer nonsense. I mean, aside from the fact that international treaties do not trump domestic law, and that's true not only in American law, but it's true in international law. But it provides an external enemy around which the NRA can rally its base, and it relies a lot on pretty hysterical rhetoric, which it has to continue with to continue contributions to win or maintain membership. And I think it undercuts the notion that the NRA is a more pragmatic organization, although I agree that in many respects it has become a more pragmatic organization, but it's pretty hard to accept that conclusion when you listen to their rhetoric, which is typically over the top.
Richard, any thoughts?
Sure. You know, there's nothing unusual about NRA if you compare other high visibility groups, the environmental movement, the animal rights movement, the pro-Israeli community. Everybody speaks in much louder tones than what if they were around a table having a professorial discussion they would probably come up with. That's part of the way the game gets played in America today. He who screams the loudest gets heard the most. So one can't look at NRA as being in a vacuum and being unique in any way, shape, or form in that regard. That's why there are other groups like mine that I'm always willing to sit down, as I did 15 years ago with Bill Clinton, or to sit down with the mayors and tell them the truth, that perhaps they don't get the truth from their police chiefs who tell them what they think they want to hear. I don't care whether it's the anti-gun community or the pro-gun community. I have a reputation of stating the facts as I see them and let the ball bounce where it does. And I think Bob will back me up on that.
I would just say that I admire Richard Feldman's approach to this, because it is, as he says, I would just add for the NRA, on the scale of heated rhetoric, I think the NRA is pretty much at the far end within interest groups in American politics.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. When we return, we'll continue our discussion about the NRA. I want to remind our listeners that we did request an interview with the NRA at the regional and or national level, and they did not respond to our request for that. But with us today, Richard Feldman, author and former regional political director for the NRA, and also Robert Spitzer. He's written a couple books about gun control in the United States and the history of gun control. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The new HBO documentary About Face features supermodels of the past, reflecting on their careers and on aging. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Beverly Johnson, the first African-American woman to be on the cover of Vogue, and Carol Alt, who's been on over 500 covers, and director Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who's photographed everyone from Barbara Bush to porn stars. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon. As a basic member of 89.7 NPR News, you'll receive a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, our airfare program guide, the WOSU FYI e-newsletter, and a WOSU grocery tote. A basic membership starts at just $60. Visit WOSU.org, and thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News. And stay with us in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour two of All Sides begins, and we will discuss the state of Central Ohio real estate. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon. And it's 80 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies for today with a high near 90. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 66 degrees. Sunshine with a chance of rain for Tuesday afternoon, possibly a thunderstorm as well, a high of 92. Partly cloudy with a chance of rain Tuesday night, a low of 69. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the NRA today. It's history, and going forward, it's politics. My guest, Robert Spitzer, political science professor, NRA member, and author of The Politics of Gun Control and the Encyclopedia of Gun Control. Coming up, we'll hear from an organization that opposes gun rights or would like to limit them in the United States, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. But first, Robert Spitzer. Robert, Barack Obama has terrible ratings from pro-gun control organizations. He has signed into law two pro-gun rights measures, I guess, one to allow them in national parks, the other to allow them on Amtrak trains. For all intents and purposes, he has done nothing to inspire the NRA's wrath, but you absolutely would think he's the lowest of the low. The way they refer to them is so just searingly negative. I'm wondering, where does that come from? What are they really afraid of?
Well, there's a couple of things to note. As you indicate, the pro-gun control side has not been happy with President Obama. The Brady campaign gave Obama an F failing grade on the gun control issue a couple of years ago. And just as you say, he's not done anything in terms of Congress or other sorts of measures on gun control, although his Justice Department has been doing some things which the gun rights side has not been happy with. But the NRA has been going after Obama since he started running for president. In his political background, Obama supported stronger gun laws when he was a member of the Illinois state legislature and then in his brief time in the U.S. Senate. So it's not surprising. Anyone would expect him to support stronger gun laws. But it's pretty clear that from the 2008 campaign on that Obama pretty well backed away from that, probably for pragmatic reasons. But it's pretty clear from his presidency that he's not been the demonic figure that the NRA has painted him. And indeed, Wayne LaPierre, the NRA's executive vice president and NRA statements have painted Obama as on the verge of taking away gun rights, and he's going to eviscerate the Second Amendment, and using just about every hysterical synonym that you could imagine to attach to Obama as being anti-gun. And it speaks to a couple things. One, I think that the NRA has most of its chips with the Republican Party, and calculates that they will do better with a Republican in the White House. They would rather see Obama defeated and the Republican nominee Mitt Romney elected. And again, they historically need a figure that they can demonize and elevate as an imminent threat to Second Amendment rights and gun ownership and gun practices. In the 1990s, it was Bill Clinton. Then it was Hillary Clinton. It was John McCain for several years because of McCain's support for campaign finance reform, which the NRA opposed. The United Nations has been a demon frequently, and now Obama. So it's in line with their sort of political strategy because it's what they use to stoke their base, to raise money, and activate their members, especially in an election year, which this is.
David in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I'm running for the Ohio General Assembly, and I am a pro-gun Democrat. And in being so, I am also not endorsed by the NRA because I'm not an absolutist. So what they do for all candidates is they send out a questionnaire, and you have to tell them your ideas on things. And if you disagree with any of their party line, you don't get the endorsement and don't get the campaign money. You know, things like gun show sales and whatnot. I just agree that it's extremely rigid in their ideology, and they use their money to promote it in politics.
Bob?
Yeah, the NRA tends to be pretty much 100% or zero in terms of how they hand out their endorsements. They're very much that way. And there are some famous examples. For example, there was a congressman from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan named Bart Stupak, who was also a conservative Democrat, a district where 60% of the people were gun owners. And he had been endorsed by the NRA throughout the 1990s. But then in 1999, Congressman Stupak supported some gun measures in Congress, and the NRA turned on him and poured a lot of money in the candidate running against him. Stupak was reelected basically by the same percentage he'd been elected earlier. But groups naturally tend to gravitate towards people that support their point of view. But the NRA is really either you're with us 100% or we're against you. They're very much that way. Go ahead.
I almost think they represent the worst of what we have in the political arena today. You know, the kind of the absolutism and the extreme, whereas I think most people are favor, you know, rights, gun rights to a point. You know, statistics bear that out. But, you know, when you're talking about absolutism, you know, there's just, it's a no-win situation. You know, the sales at gun shows and whatnot are just unreasonable.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, they are firstly a single issue group. I mean, not every interest group in American politics is focused on one and only one issue, but the NRA is, and they do take very much of an absolutist position, and that represents kind of the leading edge of what many people believe to be a problem with our politics. I would just add that if you talk to gun owners, and I think Richard Feldman would bear this out, when you mention the term gun control, and gun owners in particular become extremely suspicious. But when you get past that sort of phrase and ask them, well, if you were king, what would you like to see? What I find is that gun owners are often among the most skeptical when it comes to what really should be done in terms of gun owners. I mean, that they need proper training, that they shouldn't have unlimited access to any weapon, no matter its destructive capabilities. And gun owners, responsible gun owners, understand that a gun is a dangerous implement, that it needs to be handled with respect and care, and that not just anybody should get access to a gun. And so even, you know, gun owners, I think in many respects, understand the usefulness of basic gun regulations.
David, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Take care.
Joining us now is Ladd Everett. He's Director of Communications for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. It's an organization made up of 48 national organizations, including religious, child welfare advocates, public health professionals, and social justice organizations. Welcome to the show, Ladd Everett.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me on.
I was wondering to what extent your coalition focuses its efforts against that of the NRA.
In this business entirely, I think your last caller really put it well, and that's that, we are dealing with a vision on the gun issue from them that is really absolutist and which opposes even the most modest and sensible forms of progress in preventing people who are clearly dangerous from buying guns. And if you are in the business of wanting to save lives and wanting to prevent people like James Holmes from legally acquiring arsenals, you have to face up to the National Rifle Association and fight them. And we will continue to do that until these nightmares, these daily nightmares in this country end.
So what are your tactics? How do you beat the NRA? It seems impossible these days. People who are running for office who say they support gun rights but are not absolutist about it, say they can't get an endorsement from the NRA.
Yeah, I certainly don't believe it's impossible. There was a great article that Gail Collins wrote in the New York Times the other week called The Gun Slog, where she talked about, you know, other causes in American history that were equally worthwhile and equally tough, equally brutal to fight. And she talked about women's suffrage, and she talked about the civil rights movement. And there's a couple of ways you beat them. And the beauty of it, I think, is that it's not rocket science. They have won because we are living in an era where really our politicians are not marked by principle you know, standing on principle or great moral courage. I think the NRA wins because politicians these days, when they have to take votes on the gun issue, they are looking at a very simple equation of political pain. And they are saying to themselves, well, you know, if I vote against the National Rifle Association, I'm going to get 200 hostile calls from guys that are really into guns. They're going to be emailing me constantly. They'll show up at my town hall meetings. Maybe they'll come armed. You know, they're just going to make my they're just going to be a real pain in the butt and make my life a living hell, you know, for weeks after week. And then I think on the other side, they're saying, well, you know, if I vote against people that care about gun violence and want to stop the next James Holmes, you know, well, they'll be upset for a couple of days, maybe 2 or 3 days, and get angry at me for voting with the NRA. But then it'll die down and it'll be just fine and they'll kind of go away. We can't go away anymore. There's no magic elixir here. You can't snap your fingers and beat the NRA. The way you beat the NRA is that if you are sickened by things like Aurora, if you are tired of turning on your TV on a day-after-day basis and seeing someone who, just from a photo shot, is clearly deranged, who again legally bought an arsenal of firearms, we need to get on our politicians 24/7. We need to become that thorn on their side. We need to become the pain in their butt that never goes away. And that makes it clear to them two things. You need to make it clear two things. Number one, if you continue to vote with the NRA and put our families' lives at risk, we will vote you out of office for starters. And then number two, I will be on your phone on a daily basis with your donors, telling them to defund you. We all know people in our communities who contribute to politicians. Many of us know high-dollar donors. These are the simple building blocks of democracy, of grassroots activism that work. And these are the things, if we care enough to make this change, we need to begin to do. And we need to be honest. We've been outworked. People of conscience in this country have been outworked over the last few decades by people who love guns more than human life. Now it's time for those of us who are sickened by all this to fight back and work just as hard and even harder.
Robert Spitzer, you've said that the NRA's bark is worse than its bite. What do you know that the politicians don't know?
Well, there's a couple things. Certainly the NRA is a very influential group. They're good at lobbying. They also have a strong grassroots base around the country. It's something that a lot of interest groups don't have. But if you look at their actual record, I mean, the ability of the NRA to come into a congressional district race or, you know, any given election around the country and turn the tide in the other direction is virtually, I mean, it's hard to find cases where the NRA thumb in the scale turns a victory into a defeat or a defeat into a victory. And partly that's because American elections, by and large, don't turn on fairly narrow single issues like the gun issue. I mean, that issue is important to some people. But the NRA can make your life pretty miserable if you're a politician, if you're a political figure. It's referred to sometimes as the hassle factor. Hmm. And politicians, by and large, are a skittish lot. I mean, they'd rather not have any more political controversy in an election than they have to have. And for many, it's a lot easier to just kind of avoid that by avoiding the issue or by accepting NRA rhetoric on the gun issue than it is to fight back. Obviously, there are elected officials who do. And again, I think it's a case where the NRA's bark indeed is worse than its bite.
Well, its bite can be pretty big during a primary election, particularly for Republicans. I mean, there's lots of discussion these days about redistricting and how that works now and how it's done and how that impacts who we elect at the primary level and going forward, creating more extremes on both sides. So to what effect might that be affecting firearms regulations in the U.S. and Lat Everett, is that an issue for your organization?
Yeah, no. Getting back to something you said a minute ago, I'm not convinced that the NRA does have a significant effect on elections or even primary battles.
Okay.
I would refer your listeners to a really good 4-part series of articles that Paul Waldman, a writer for the American Prospect, just put out. It's called The Myth of NRA Dominance. And Paul actually got in and looked specifically at the last, I think, 3 or 4 election cycles to determine, did the NRA really have the impact that they claim to have had? And he found they didn't. He looked at both presidential elections and congressional elections. He looked at the power of their money, but he also looked at the power of their endorsement. And he found that the only discernible impact they had were for people who were Republican challengers in races, But for Democrats and for Republican incumbents, he could not find any statistical bump whatsoever that they provided to folks. So, echoing, what other people have said, your callers and also Robert, I think it's important to go back to the drawing board and take a closer look. Do they really have the impact that they say they do? And I think the answer is clearly no.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Yes, I'm a retired police officer, over 34 years. I believe we have enough gun laws on the books. As far as the gun shows go, 99% of the people at the gun shows are dealers. They have to do a background check right there. And I think we have to understand the NRA is trying to support gun rights, the Second Amendment rights, but are being challenged. Obama's on the record as being against gun rights. He wants to do this UN treaty thing, which would ban pretty much all guns for private ownership in the United States if we signed the treaty. I'll take my comments off here.
Okay, and Robert Spitzer, you mentioned earlier that that's not the case as far as banning gun ownership in the United States regarding the UN treaty.
Yeah, it's not the case. It's just not true. I mean, it's something that's been repeated a lot by the NRA, but it's a good example of something where it's putting information out there to stoke up people around the country, and it's factually incorrect. First of all, the UN treaty is out to try and get a handle on illicit international small arms trafficking. I mean, that's its purpose. And secondly, regardless of the text of that agreement, and it has not, they have not reached a final agreement, and you know, who knows, maybe they even won't. But even if they do, international law does not trump American domestic law or domestic law in any other countries. I would just add that David was referring to, people may not know, to the so-called gun show loophole, which in many states refers to the fact that a private gun sale can occur at a gun show if it does not involve a federally licensed dealer, and it can occur without a background check. In some states, background checks must occur for all gun sales at gun shows, but in other states, not.
Lad Everett, we just have about 30 seconds left. It sounds like when you hear someone like David talk that the NRA does have a lot of clout. People listen to what the NRA says.
Well, I think to a degree, but I mean, I think you can also, pick up from that from hearing what he said about how they raise money through conspiracy theories that are just blatant falsehoods. And I think, listening to that, listening to these, ridiculous stories about what the UN is going to do to domestic laws and whatnot, I think this reinforces that it's important for all of us, who base decisions on reason and fact, to speak to people in communities about, what happened at Aurora, what Obama has done and really hasn't done on guns.
Okay. Lad Everett, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob.
Lad Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and Robert Spitzer, thank you as well for joining us today in this conversation.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.